could there be some big changes coming to the state constitution? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Florida Constitution Revision Commission has narrowed down hundreds of ideas for new amendments to a couple of dozen. Now members of the commission are grouping some of these proposals together to limit the number of items that will appear on the ballot in November. We'll get the details from one of the commissioners. Also,
sometimes the world is not such a beautiful place. I posit that words can help us cope and deal.
Poet and novelist Kwame Alexander is coming to town to surprise some students tomorrow. We'll talk to him about his new book, Rebound, and the power of poetry for protest. Finally, you've probably seen Carol Furman's work. She's a pioneer in the world of hyper-realistic sculpture. Some of her pieces are here in South Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, if you're a regular listener to Sundial, you've probably heard Florida is in the middle of something that only happens every 20 years. Don't worry, we're not talking about locusts or anything like that. It's the constitutional revision process. A group of commissioners has taken suggestions from the public, made some of their own, and they've come up with a plan for how to arrange the finalists on the ballot so we can vote on them in November. Now, back to talk to us through this complicated process is one of the commissioners, Tim Serio. He's an attorney and former general counsel to Governor Scott. And we're talking to him at our sister public radio station, WFSU, in Tallahassee. Tim Serio, great to have you back.
Well, thank you, Lewis. Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure.
All right, so remind us how many proposed amendments the commission got all together in this process.
Well, we had thousands of proposals that were filed by members of the public, mostly citizens of the state of Florida. Some came in from outside the state. We combed through those, and from those proposals, commissioners took some of these proposals either directly or refined them a bit or combined them with other proposals. And there were 123 proposals filed by commissioners of the Constitution Revision Commission.
And now you've narrowed that down, and you still have to narrow it down some more, but we're down to what? Just a couple dozen?
I believe we're down to 24 of the proposals that were filed, and we have now combined them for purposes of placing them on the, for further consideration and placing them on the ballot. We combine these proposals where it's appropriate. We combine them for presentation to the voters. So out of these 24 proposals, I think we're down, or proposed amendments, we're down to, I think, 12 proposals that are up for final consideration, and then some may pass, some may not pass, and those will be placed on the ballot that do pass.
So we could see 12 things on the ballot for vote or not. It's up to you. There's one more vote you have.
That's correct. We could see up to 12 more, and remember that the legislature, through joint resolution, has some proposals or a proposal on the ballot, and through citizen initiatives, there's some citizen initiative proposals on the ballot. There are five, for both of those, there are five total, and then what the CRC, the Constitution Revision Commission, includes will be added on to those five. So Proposal 1 of the Constitution Revision Commission will actually be Proposal 6 on the ballot. So one of the things that we're mindful of, Lewis, is we don't want to give the voters, you know, voting fatigue. So that factors into the analysis of what should move forward and what shouldn't.
All right, let's go through some of these.
Sure.
One amendment, groups some, not all, of the education proposals into one. What are they?
So let's see, the education proposals, the thought was to combine higher ed proposals together to the extent we can, and some general ed proposals. There are proposals that deal with school board term limits, operation of the school system, civic literacy, which was a proposal by former Senator Don Gates on making sure that our schools are teaching, I guess what you would call the fundamentals of a constitutional republic, making sure our students understand that. On the higher ed side, they're provisions that deal with basically requiring supermajorities to raise fees and tuition. for students to keep education affordable and keep costs down.
And you have your amendment you proposed, Marcy's Law, which expands victims' rights. It's going to be grouped with other proposals dealing with the court system.
That is right. That is right. Again, we don't want to give the voters voter fatigue. I think the Constitution Revision Commission, the first one was 40 years ago. The second one was 20 years ago, and we are the third CRC. Each of those previous CRCs, they group proposals together in a way that does seem to make sense. And the only requirement for us is that we have to have a ballot summary language to present to the voters that is clear and understandable, not ambiguous, and that makes sense. So for purposes of grouping, Marcy's Law, the proposal I filed, was grouped with a proposal regarding judicial deference and basically saying that when courts make decisions affecting citizens, the courts get to decide those issues de novo or on their own. They don't have to defer or at least give extra credence to government or a state agency that the case arose out of. The other issue is judicial retirement. We are raising the age of retirement of Florida's judges from 70 to 75.
I was looking too. There's one amendment that combines oil drilling and vaping. That just seems like a very odd combination.
They are odd. I guess that you could say that, well, they both kind of promote healthy Florida. But the thought was that either one of these, you know, we're trying not to have standalone proposals unless it's just absolutely necessary. And I think that the sponsors were amenable. We were able to draft ballot summary language that did make sense. So that's why those proposals were presented together. And again, when we meet for our final meetings next week as a commission, there will be chance. You know, if members want to try and separate these out or refer them back to the style and drafting committee that initially handled the groupings, they can do that or vote to amend these proposals or vote them down.
Because you have to write the language in such a way to make it as clear as possible for the voter. But you're combining these different ideas. Let me come back to yours, Marcy's Law. So is there any concern that as you combine these that, well, it might change? Because when we talked about this months ago, you felt there's support for this. But right. Are you worried that if it's combined with something else, maybe the voter gets confused or they'd like, well, I'm not sure I'm for this now?
There's no question that's always a consideration. And I, as the sponsor of Marcy's Law, I'm very concerned that, you know, I was bird dogging the language. And fortunately, I was also a member of the Style and Drafting Committee, and we worked with some great, great outside counsel that the CRC hired to help us with this. Former appellate court judge Chris Altenburn, Tallahassee attorney Barry Richard, and Tallahassee attorney Jason Gonzalez. These folks have a lot of constitutional experience. And so I am comfortable that the way Marcy's Law is grouped with these judicial proposals, that that the voters will understand them. I think the language is very clear. I mean, you know, well, to sound a little bit of a, as a proud sponsor, I think that Marcy's Law will probably buoy these other proposals. At least I hope, and I think that's the right thing to do. I'm not upset about that at all. But certainly, there are proposals that may boost others, and there may be groupings that certain proposals may bring others down. We'll have to see. We just do the best we can.
Right. There's an amendment that combines some measures dealing with law enforcement. This one includes a little controversial one here, that Miami-Dade County must elect its sheriff instead of appointing him or her. Why are voters across the state going to care about how Miami-Dade chooses their sheriff?
I think that's a good question. I think that I don't think Miami-Dade is certainly impacted. I think there are other counties that are impacted, if I remember correctly. This wasn't an issue that I wasn't a sponsor of it, but I certainly followed it. Volusia County will be impacted. And I believe the thought is that the reason that at least the sponsors thought is that the reason voters across the state may care is that it is more of an operation of what can charters, when there's a charter government, what should a charter be able to do or not do? And, you know, it has, you are absolutely right, Lewis. It has been one of the more controversial proposals.
All right. Again, you have one more vote coming up, but is any more of the process open to the public to see or at least be witnessed to in any way? Or is it now just up to you guys?
Well, absolutely, the public can view it. There's live broadcast on the Florida Channel, but we're on the floor of the Florida Senate. There's really no opportunity now during the proceedings of the CRC for the public to weigh in, because we are now debating these proposals and taking final votes. So if members of the public have concerns, I would urge you definitely reach out to, if you know who the commissioners are, reach out to them, reach out to the Constitution Revision Commission office here in Tallahassee. They can provide you with contact info. It's not too late to weigh in, but once we hit the floor, you know, unlike these public hearings we've held around the state, there isn't an opportunity during the debate of these proposals for the public to weigh in at that point.
All right. When we first talked to you, you told me you really wanted to be on a Constitutional Revision Commission. All right. So now that the process is nearing the end, what did you think of it?
I think that when some time passes, Lewis, I will look back fondly on this experience after some healing and some therapy. But no, all kidding aside, it has been a real privilege. It's been a privilege to be a part of it. There has been a lot of controversy. There has been some ups and downs. But I mean, we are sort of and I hate to put it this way, but I mean, I think it's fair to say it is a bit of a quasi-legislative body or a sort of legislative body. I mean, we are presenting these things for the voters to consider. We don't pass them ourselves. But one of the compliments that we've received, as well as the criticisms we've received, is that we've operated as sort of in effect, a mini legislature, which, again, some people aren't real happy with that. And other folks.
Real briefly, but you know what? Real briefly, though, because I'm curious. I know you have a lot of passion for Marcy's Law, but will you take it personal if the voters shoot down most of these?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, it's our job to present these things to the voters, and we do the best we can to put these proposals together. And we realize that once we've done our work and hand this product over to the Secretary of State to prepare for the ballot, that our work is done. And the voters, by a 60% vote, it's not a majority, the voters to amend the Constitution requires a 60% vote. It's in their hands, and we just have to trust they'll make the right decision. And if Marcy's Law, and I think Marcy's Law is obviously a really powerful victims' rights proposal that should be in the Constitution. But if the voters disagree on other matters, I don't think we'll take it personally.
All right. Tim Serio, again, an attorney, former general counselor to Governor Scott, and he's one of the commissioners on the Florida Revision Constitution Commission. He's one of those commissioners. And again, they got one more vote. They've got to put all these proposals together so they don't have too many things on the ballot for us in November. Tim, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis. Appreciate you letting me come back.
All right, still to come on Sundial.
I skipped school today and drank soda and didn't eat lunch, and I almost got arrested, and I hate math, and tomorrow we have to play basketball in gym class, and I'm not that good, and I'm not that good at anything, and who's going to teach me everything, and do I need to get a job?
A conversation with children's author Kwame Alexander. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you may be familiar with our next guest. He became a big player in the children's literary world with his book, Crossover. It's written in the form of verse.
A quick shoulder shake, a slick eye fake. Number 28 is way past late. He's reading me like a book, but I turn the page and watch him look, which can only mean I got him shook. His feet are the bank, and I'm the crook. Breaking, breaking, taking him to the left. Now he's took. Number 14 joins in. Now he's on the hook. I got two in my kitchen. I'm fixing to cook. Prepping my meal, ready for glass. Nobody's expecting Filthy to pass. I see Vondi under the hoop, so I serve him up my alley-oop.
Can I just listen to that guy for hours and hours? Kwame Alexander is visiting two schools in Miami tomorrow. He's going to be in his Rebound Rockstar tour bus. I can't say which schools because, well, he likes to surprise students. We reached him earlier today at public radio station WGVU in Grand Rapids.
Absolutely not. I thought Crossover was a one-off. I thought I was, you know, telling this story that I needed to tell, and that was it. And as I began to travel and meet young people who had read the book, the question kept coming up, is there a sequel? Are you going to keep talking about the Bell family? And I am a say yes person. I love saying yes. I love walking through doors, figuring out what's on the other side and making it happen. And so enough kids asked me that it got me thinking. And of course, I've always wanted to sort of write about this time of my life that was really fun and cool and adventurous and exciting. And that was the 80s when I was a tween and a teen. And so it dawned on me that perhaps I could continue the Bell story by writing about the father and the crossover when he was 12 during the 1980s.
And like crossover, it's a beautiful story told in verse. And I'm wondering, why is verse such a powerful way to tell a story?
Because you can talk about these really heavy, emotionally weighty topics, themes, subjects, feelings, and you can do it in a way where it's not a whole lot of words. You can do it in a way where you're using rhythm and you're getting the reader sort of caught up. You can do it in a way where it's not intimidating to, quote, reluctant readers because there's so much white space. And you can do it in a way where it's palatable, it's digestible, like we can handle these things that are being talked about, whether it's, you know, loss, love, you know, the state of America, police brutality. Anybody can connect with it because poetry at its core is about feeling, is about that emotional connection. And I think it allows us to have that relationship to the topic at hand.
Can you read a sample of the poem "I Skipped School Today" for us?
I skipped school today and drank soda and didn't eat lunch and I almost got arrested and I hate math and tomorrow we have to play basketball in gym class and I'm not that good and I'm not that good at anything and who's going to teach me everything and do I need to get a job and why is everybody always sorry and CJ's dad is so cool and I'm not taking a shower tonight because I didn't do anything all day but read comics and play Pac-Man and I still don't feel any better than I did last week or yesterday or when I woke up and I'm tired. So can I please just stay in my room, turn out the lights and hide inside the darkness that owns me? Please.
This is the story of Chuck the Man Bell, father of Josh and Jordan Bell from Crossover. Tell us about Chuck.
Chuck, as a father, is the cool dad. He's a funny dad. He's an ambitious, you know, sort of man who was successful on the basketball court and in life and created this really rich familial environment for his wife and his two sons. So he's just the dad you like to hang out with. He's teaching his kids how to be not only stars on the court, but how to be stars off the court. He's teaching them how to grow into becoming men. And so that's the crossover. And so when I wrote Rebound, of course, I had to show you the origins of this man who became Chuck Bell, because he wasn't always the baller. He wasn't always the wise, you know, sage. He was a kid named Charlie Bell who had no idea how to play basketball, didn't like it, was dealing with his own loss of his father. And all the puzzle pieces just seemed to be strewed out all over, you know, his life. And he had to figure out how to put them back together. And with the help of family and friends and ultimately this sport that he didn't like, basketball, he does. That's Chuck Bell.
You know, your story, I mean, for any writer, really inspiring, because publishers just kept passing you up. They just, they were not into it. You got a lot of rejections. How many?
I got 22 rejections, but who's counting?
And you probably kept them all, too.
I did. I kept all of them. Over 5 years, 22 rejections. And it was disappointing. It was frustrating. It was sad. It was heartbreaking, you know, but throughout that process, I knew that it was a good book. I knew that it was something that I enjoyed writing and reading. And I figured that kids would too. So I stuck with it with the help of friends and family who encouraged me.
And then you got that one yes. What was that like?
It was pretty amazing. I mean, I told my wife, I said, honey, I think we're going to be rich. This is it. We've made it. And of course, we weren't going to be rich because it was a really small amount of money, but it wasn't even about the money. It was about this idea that this book I had spent so much time on, that I'd been rejected by so many people, finally, you know, had an audience, that Houghton Mifflin Harcourt was going to publish it. And so that was validating. It really solidified this idea, this notion that if you believe in yourself enough, if you are persistent, if you're committed to your worth, if you know your worth and you're committed to it, and you hang in there, like, good things can happen. It's not just a cliche. Like, the universe is conspiring to allow you to live your fullest dreams, but you got to put in the work and you got to be consistent. So it was a great, you know, sort of affirmation for the way I live my life to get that book deal.
Who are some of your inspirations as writers? Who inspired you most?
My parents were writers, so definitely my parents. Nikki Giovanni was a professor at Virginia Tech, and I studied with her for 3 years, so she was a tremendous influence on my work and inspiration. And certainly writers like Langston Hughes and Pablo Neruda and E.E. Cummings and so forth.
Did I read this right, that you actually were studying medicine before you got into writing?
I don't know if you can call it studying. I was majoring in biochemistry.
There you go. Okay.
And I planned on being a doctor, and then I encountered organic chemistry sophomore year. And so I changed my major quickly to English.
Okay. I mean, look, I know that if I had, you know, told my parents, you know, I just don't want to take this anymore. I want to write. I probably would have gotten, well, a stare and then a lecture. What was it like for you, though, when you made that decision? I'm like, no, this isn't me.
I mean, again, they were writers. So I had that luxury. I had grown up around books. My father was a book publisher. They both had studied children's literature. So I was immersed in language and literature. And so when I made that decision to be a writer, you know, there was a lot of support there because they had essentially nurtured, molded, and shaped me to become a writer. So it sort of worked. When I told my dad I was going to write poetry now, he told me that was crazy. I'd never make a living writing poetry. Now, he's super proud. He gets it. And he tells me the only reason he told me I wasn't going to make any money was to see if I was going to be committed to it. So, you know, I'm a 25-year overnight success.
That's a good way to put it. How did you distinguish yourself from your writing from your parents' writing?
My parents were academics. So my dad wrote boring, incomprehensible, staid tomes that I had to read as a kid. I had to read his dissertations. So it wasn't really a whole lot of fun in his writing. At least for a kid. My mother wrote stories. She was a storyteller, so her stuff was really interesting. I think I found a way to sort of balance both of them and find my own voice.
Do you remember your first poem ever?
It was a poem I wrote on Mother's Day when I was 12 years old. Dear Mommy, I hate Mother's Day because in my heart, every day is Mother's Day, and I love you, dear Mommy. It was something like that, but it was whack. But she loved it. She cried. She cried these tears of joy. So, that was sort of a moment where I said, wow, words are powerful.
You told me about how many times you'd been rejected for a crossover. When did you start writing that?
2008. I started writing it the summer of 2008. And I spent a lot of time in coffee houses working on it in particular. I wrote a great deal of it in Panera Bread.
They're going to love to hear that. That's perfect for them. But when you were writing it, were you creating this format and again, telling this story in verse in all of these pieces that seem to come together so beautifully? Or, I mean, how did you come to that process?
I wasn't the first person to do that. I mean, certainly when you look at the poets like Langston Hughes and Nikki Giovanni, and they're telling stories in their poems. Like, there are characters and there's a beginning, middle, and end. And then when you look at sort of full length text, novels and verse, Karen Hess's book, Out of the Dust, Ann Berg's book, All the Broken Pieces, Sharon Creech's book, Love That Dog. So there were people who had done it, and they'd done it pretty well. And so I knew that it was possible to do it. And so how to do it in a way that was a little bit different, unique, using my authentic voice. You know, that is what took the 5 years to sort of figure that out. And, you know, it was 5 hours a day for 5 years, rewriting, and eventually I figured it out. The new book is Rebound, and I guess it's my fourth novel in verse after the crossover, and I feel like I just figured out how to do it.
Why do you think it took that many rejections? What is it that publishers didn't see? Again, you're speculating because you have to get into their minds, but I'm curious of why they didn't seem to spot that.
Well, I was told that poetry wasn't going to sell, the same thing my father had told me 20-some years before, or that boys weren't going to read poetry, or that girls weren't going to read a sports book. So those were sort of the basic things. And the idea of writing a basketball novel and using poetry to tell the story. Like, I would imagine conventional wisdom, you know, says that's never gonna work. I always knew it would because I was able to see those connections between the movement, the energy, the rhythm on the court, and what's happening on the page if you can make the words jump off the page, if you can make them come off the stage. A quick shoulder shake, a slick eye fake. Number 28 is way past late. He's reading me like a book, but I turn the page and watch him look, which can only mean I got him shook. His feet are the bank, and I'm the crook. Breaking, breaking, taking him to the left. Now he's took. Number 14 joins in. Now he's on the hook. I got two in my kitchen. I'm fixing to cook. Prepping my meal, ready for glass. Nobody's expecting Filthy to pass. I see Vondi under the hoop, so I serve him up my alley-oop. So that's a couplet. That's a rhyming couplet. But how do you write a poem that's going to mirror what's happening on the court? And I kind of got a glimpse of how that could work, and I just ran with it.
You're listening to a conversation we had with noted author and poet Kwame Alexander. His book Crossover won the Newbery Award. His new book is Rebound. We'll have more on this conversation just ahead on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Let's return to our conversation with author and poet Kwame Alexander. You might know him from his Newbery Award-winning book, Crossover. He has a new book, the prequel to that, called Rebound. He's going to be in South Florida tomorrow visiting a couple of different schools. Now, he likes to surprise students, so we're not going to tell you which schools he's going to. But let's get back to that conversation. What's the process when you're putting a book like Rebound together? Is it you're writing it in pieces? Do you start at the beginning, work to the end? Do you write an outline? I mean, like, unlike a normal novel, I guess a regular novel, I mean, what's the process in creating this?
It's the same. I mean, ultimately you're writing a story. You're writing a novel. You got to have a beginning, middle, and end. You got to have strong characters. You got to have developed characters. You got to have a plot. You got to have some conflict. Got to have some resolution. I mean, the only thing you're doing now is, in addition to doing that, now you're trying to not use as many words. Now you're trying to make sure that on each page there is figurative language because you're not using so many words. So you have to paint a picture so that the reader can sort of fill in those gaps. I think it's a little bit more challenging to write a novel in verse because you're telling a story and you're writing poems that have to stand up on each page. And I think ultimately the read, and I'm going to be kind of biased, I guess, is going to be, I think, more fulfilling, especially for young people, because you're trying to get them to critically think, to figure stuff out. And I think that white space on the page in a novel in verse is for that kind of journey, that spiritual journey.
Talking about young people, and you're going to be talking, well, let me start with this. You spoke last January on NPR about the ability of poetry to be used for protest, and you're going to be talking to students in Miami tomorrow, and you've got students here in South Florida who have been engaged in protest since the Parkland shooting.
You know, and that's sort of how I found my way to verse, is through the protest poetry of Langston Hughes. I too am America. It's through the social protest poetry of poets like Nikki Giovanni and Lucille Clifton. Again, you're dealing with things that are happening in the world that are dramatic, traumatic, that are wrong, that are dangerous, that are impacting our ability to sort of live in a world that is beautiful. Sometimes the world is not such a beautiful place. I posit that A, words can help us cope and deal. I posit that B, words can share. They can allow us to talk about these things that matter to us and share with other people, that they can inform and inspire others. I think that words are powerful, and ultimately they can transform us. They can allow us to become more connected to each other. I think poetry can allow us to become more human. I think we find our voices, we raise our voices. Like, in order for things to happen, in order for things to change, in order for like a behavior, an action to change, it has to first begin with the mind. Like, you got to think it. You got to want it to change. In order for you to want something to change, like in an immediate way, like the students at Parkland want things to change for the better for them, for us, you got to feel it. Like, it has to start in the heart. If you feel something, you're going to be a little bit more apt to think it possible. And so what better way to sort of invoke that feeling of change than through the most emotionally resonant and powerful language, I believe, and that is poetry. Maya Angelou did it. For centuries, poets, you know, have used their verse to challenge the system, to challenge injustice, to galvanize resistance, to empower communities. And so, yeah, I think it's perfect. It's perfect for young people.
I wanted to ask you about, you are going to launch your own imprint, Versify. This is through your publisher, for young readers. And you're looking for writers like you who are looking to break out of that traditional boundary of storytelling. Are you looking for poets mostly?
No, I get asked that a lot. I'm looking for good books. Certainly, I got an affinity for verse and hybrid books. But I'm looking for good books that are going to tell stories that are going to inspire young people, that are going to entertain them, you know, that are going to ultimately, you know, make them want to pick up another book. I'm just looking for really good books. And it's so great to have this opportunity to launch Versify to do this.
You already have a few writers, correct?
We have 4 books on the initial list, which publishes in the spring of 2019. Lamar Giles has written a fantasy novel, which is sort of a throwback to the Phantom Tollbooth. We have a novel in verse written by Kip Wilson about 19-year-old German teenagers who are resistant. They've started a resistance to Nazi Germany and to Hitler. And it's about their work, which is so apropos today. I think it's very inspiring for young people to show that they can, you know, have a voice, raise a voice, and make, you know, have an impact. We have a couple picture books. So, yeah, we've got some books, and I'm excited about what we're launching with and looking forward to discovering new writers to finding the next crossover.
Are writers and poets of color getting enough opportunities in the publishing game today?
Are people of color getting enough opportunity in the world, in the country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, writing and publishing is just a microcosm of what's happening. We got to do better. We got to do better. We got to do better at making sure that, you know, everybody has an opportunity to shine, to show their stuff, to, you know, to do what it is they want to do in this life, and to be and the things that they love. You know, we got to make sure that all people have the opportunity. So, I mean, the short of it is no. But that's why, you know, you got to do the work. You got to make sure that you are constantly trying to figure out how to change that. I posit that working with young people is my way to do it. Because for the most part, I think sometimes as adults, you know, we're the ones who sort of are the problem. The kids sort of are a lot more evolved and advanced in their thinking than we are a lot more human. And so if I can help nurture and encourage that, perhaps this next generation won't be having to ask that question.
I can't let you go without asking you this, because I'd read about this as well, that you like to surprise your readers sometimes with visits, and that you know, sometimes you just, you know, somebody's written to you or they've reached out to you, and then you just pop up and show up and say hi and start talking to them. I mean, that sounds like fun. I wish some of my favorite writers growing up had done that to me, but that's okay. Why do that? And what kind of conversations come from those kind of surprise visits?
My mother used to surprise me a lot as a kid. There was a big thing in my house. When you got surprised, or when she said, I got a surprise for you, like, that was the biggest thing, man. So I grew up loving surprises. And as I began to travel around the world talking about my books and literature and poetry, I'd get a lot of letters, a lot of fan mail. And I remember being in one city in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I got this really touching letter and just decided to surprise this kid because I was, you know, he hadn't read a book ever until he read The Crossover. And so I did, man, and it was pandemonium. He was beating me up. He couldn't believe I was there. And it was amazing. You know, contrarily, I went to a house and surprised a kid last week. In Providence, Rhode Island, and he was a little shy. He was overwhelmed with joy to the point where he could not speak. So you just get a variety of reaction, but the idea is that hopefully, you know, these young people know that they matter, that I care, because I can't write back to every letter and every email I receive. But it also does me some good, man. It reinvigorates me and gets me excited to keep up the good fight.
Well, you are going to surprise somebody here, but we're not going to say where you're going because it's a surprise. So we'll leave it at that. Kwame Alexander, again, he's author of the Newbery Award-winning book Crossover. His new book is Rebound, which is the prequel to Crossover. And again, he's going to be in South Florida tomorrow for two events. Again, surprise. We'll keep it at that. Kwame, it's been an absolute pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And my understanding, again, is that he's got his big Rebound Rockstar tour bus, so he's going to be driving around in that, or riding around in that tomorrow. So great conversation with Mr. Alexander. Well, still to come on Sundial, her form of sculpture is known as hyperrealism. There's a special art series going on in West Palm Beach this week. We'll have more on that coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Carol Furman is a pioneer of hyper-realistic sculpture. You can see her work in Miami Beach as well as New York City and around the world. She created one of her most iconic pieces, Survival of Serena, in response to the arrival of Cuban immigrants in the Keys in the early 80s. She'll be at Culture Lab in West Palm Beach this Saturday for an artist conversation. It's part of a 10-day-long series of events called Art Affair in West Palm Beach, and it continues through the weekend. And Carol joins us now from the NPR New York Bureau. Carol, it's such a pleasure. Welcome to Sundial.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, let's start by explaining that art form, hyperrealism. How do you define it?
Well, hyperrealism takes realism to another level. It's more than a flat painting. It's a three-dimensional object, which is so real that you'd think a person is standing right in front of you. And in the case of my sculptures, many of them have their eyes closed, and people tell me they think the eyes are going to open any minute.
What got you into this?
Well, I thought I was going to be a painter, and actually I am a painter because I paint these sculptures, hyperrealistic sculptures, as if they're three-dimensional canvases. And I started doing it when I was an illustrator, and I started doing three-dimensional illustrations, like for the cover of National Lampoon and for Rolling Stones and all different other magazines. And I did a three-dimensional portrait, like a life cast of Nose to the Grindstone, it was called, and it was a man with his nose cut off. And it was read around the world. I got all sorts of mail. And I was thinking, I don't want to do a man's nose cut off. If I'm going to do these three-dimensional sculptures, I want to do my own subjects and my own thoughts. And so I started doing it, and that was in the mid-1970s.
Of course, I mentioned one of your most iconic sculptures that really launched you into the public eye, Survival of Serena. Describe that first, real quick.
Everybody loves that, Survival of Serena. I started it in 1981, and I was moved by the immigrants that were coming in from Key West. They were floating in on floats and tubes, and there were movies about them, and it was really very touching and very moving for me. And I wanted to do a sculpture of a woman resting or floating on an inner tube with a lot of meaning, like survival. And some people even look at it and say they think she's birthing. But I was very moved. We had a apartment in Key West, and I saw this image of a woman lying on a tube very peacefully. And I went back to my studio, looked for someone to pose for me, bought an inner tube and inflated it, and I put this piece together. I cast the girl on the tube, and painted it. Never ever realizing it would go on to become so world famous.
I want to ask you about your process, because you look at these pieces, and it's, again, it's called hyperrealism, but it's the sense that you can almost touch that sculpture, and it's going to just look at you, come to life. As you said, you always do with their eyes closed, and people tell you they feel those eyes are about to open. But what do you use? I'm just curious, in the material, how do you create that realism?
Well, the earlier sculptures were done in resin and oil painted, and most of them were sold to people, and they put them in their homes. But in 2015, I was invited to show my work in the Venice Biennale, and the curator asked me to take the Survival of Serena and another swimmer called Grande Catalina and blow them up and make them monumental size. And he said to me, if the pyramids were small, nobody would go to Egypt. So I had very little time, but I used the technical 3D computerized way of blowing them up. In those days, it was just the beginning, and they didn't have anything too fine. So I blew them up, and they came in a foam, which had to be detailed and filled in with, I put plaster all over it, and I had to fill it in, and then I had to make a mold of this foam, and then I had to cast an epoxy resin positive into the rubber mold. And it was this epoxy resin positive that I painted, detailed, and that got shipped off to the Venice Biennale as my first two public monumental works.
And when you find people, because you actually have models to help you in this process, correct?
Yes.
When you find people, how do you find them? And I read that you use more than one person for one sculpture.
Sometimes I use more than one. Survival of Serena and Catalina were the same model who posed for me, but many times they're Frankensteins with other people who pose the hands or the feet or a different face. But in this case, for these two iconic pieces, I used the same model. And I was really surprised because in Italy, people were waiting online 20 minutes to see the piece and to kiss. Actually, they were kissing Survival of Serena, and she surpassed even Grande Catalina in people loved it, and they put it on the cover of the magazine for the Biennale.
We talk about some of your other sculptures, and people may have seen this. A lot of people probably have passed by it. Recently in Miami Beach, your sculpture Strength was placed in front of the National Hotel. First, describe that. It's two dancers depicted, and just describe a little bit about that.
Yes, it's one dancer, and he's on the balls of his feet, and he's lifting up a female dancer her body is in an arch, almost a circle, which I asked her to actually pose into. So her body would look like infinity, and his body would look like it makes the stem, so it looks like the symbol of love. But for me, it was more than the strength of the two of them being able to do this piece. It was the fact that there was an inner strength and a struggle to achieve something. And this is a theme that runs through all my work, this survival, this strength, courage, trust. And so the pieces are all very symbolical, even though to an untrained passerby who doesn't know too much about art, it's perfectly okay to just see it as two dancers.
There's an incredible story behind the male dancer that was your model for strength.
Yes. Little did I know, but I had a lot of models posing for me to see who looked good in the pose, and I picked a wonderful young black male model and a beautiful woman, and I did this piece on them, and it got installed in front of the National Hotel. It's 16 feet in bronze, and he went to see the sculptor, the dancer, who posed for me, and he said to me, this meant so much for the Afro-American community and for the homeless community, because I was once homeless, and they're doing a documentary on me that's going to air on TV, and they would like you to be in it. So I'm pretty excited, and it was just an outcome I hadn't expected.
What are you working on next? What's the inspiration? What's driving you in a new direction? What is that direction?
Well, I keep constantly working on those themes of perseverance and strength, and I am I'm working on a few new pieces. One is it's called The Girl with the Hat, and it's also very illusional, where she's holding a gigantic red hat in front of her. And I had this hat custom made for the sculpture, and you only see like her legs coming out and her face, she's very mysterious. And a lot of the pieces that I've been working on lately, like Lita and the Swan and some of the others, are very magical. They move into the realm of fantasy and astrology.
I wanted to finish up with this. This past October, you spoke at the International Women's Forum in Houston about women becoming more politically engaged. How much would you say your work is political?
My work is somewhat political, but in a different realm than some of the other activist artists, like the Guerrilla Girls or Ai Weiwei or some of the others, because my work really tells that you should make the most of every day and count your blessings and be happy, and the best things in life are free, and all those other things that I want to say. So publicly, my message is not an activist kind of message. It's more like a message that people should realize that we're here for a short time. We have to make the most of it, and we should try to appreciate what we have.
Again, I've been talking with sculptor Carol Furman. Her sculpture, by the way, it's hyper-realistic. It's hyper-realism, as she's a pioneer of this style. And you've seen, like I said, you've probably seen some of her work. It's here in Miami Beach. She's got work in New York City and around the world. Now, she is going to be at the Culture Lab in West Palm Beach this Saturday. It's for an artist conversation. And again, this is part of the 10-day-long series of events called Art Affair in West Palm Beach. And again, it continues through this weekend. Carol, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And enjoy your trip to South Florida this weekend. All right, that's the end of the program for today and for the week. Happy Friday tomorrow. Have a great weekend. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you next week.